Welcome to SciGuys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, the leverageable Luke Cutler.
I can't be bought.
This week, we're talking about... I feel like I've seen this all before.
Oh God, not again.
But first we gotta thank our patrons. Thanks, patrons. For making this show possible. And everyone else who isn't a patron.
Grumble, grumble.
And the question for this week, if you're on YouTube, get down to the comments and answer it. And if you're not on YouTube and you're listening to the podcast somewhere like Apple or Spotify or anywhere else, you've got to do something very special. I need for you to wrap up the answer to the question. I need to wrap it up like a present. I need you to throw it at someone dressed as Santa Claus and scream your name at them. That way they'll know who you are and that you're on the nice list because you're a SciGuys listener. And that Santa will do you the justice of delivering that answer to us. Or you'll be charged for assault. Who knows what'll happen? Anyway, the question for this week is, what was your favorite SciGuys episode of 2023?
Oh, I don't know. I can't remember any of them.
Luke, remember one single episode of SciGuys from 2023?
We had the one with Jamie Raines. I really like that one. The second one with Jamie Raines.
That is
genuinely one of my favorite episodes we've ever done.
That's
so
good. I mean, we did just record a bunch of episodes.
Oh, I can't remember any of them.
So
you could literally like do those episodes again and I'd be like, oh, I think I read something about this stuff once. Like, I'd remember little bits, but then I would remember that you told me.
That has actually happened in episodes before. You have parroted back to me information that I have given to you on this podcast.
I'm not surprised.
But no, my favorite episode of this past year can be found in the playlist of Corey's faves. And Luke agrees in saying that you can find his faves in the playlist of Luke's faves.
You can. Yeah, I personally curated that list. Definitely wasn't just Corey going, these are the ones that Luke will probably think are his faves.
Okay, look, here's what happened. Luke chose his favorites and then stopped doing that. And so I just know what ones he likes. So I'm going to be honest. I do a lot of Luke on this podcast, right? Like a lot of the Luke that you see, it's just my hand up at him like a Muppet.
Yeah, right now I'm a deep fake.
And I'm deep into it.
Oh, God.
So, we're talking about déjà vu, aren't we? Do you know what déjà vu is, Luke?
Yeah, okay. What, phenomenologically or mentally?
Just answer the question, man.
Okay, yes. I do. Is that what you wanted? No, it wasn't. So déjà vu is the experience of feeling like you've been in this moment before. Like you've just experienced something that you've already experienced.
So my fingies on my left hand is water, and my fingers on my right hand is alcohol.
Are they interlocking?
And they're now interlocking. If you're listening, Luke, if you're listening, what's happened is I've interlocked my two hands. Dissolving is when one like chemical hides in the spaces between another.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So when you dissolve alcohol in water,
like
what happens
those
is
fish
the alcohol...
where one of them pretends to be a woman.
Seahorses?
That happens, doesn't it?
That's not seahorses, but it is... Yes, there are some fish that...
Transvestites.
Guys, I very much need for you to not get me so off track that I'm explaining things like fish and their different mating properties. Yes, there are some fish where there are two different kinds of males, where there's a big, strong male and there's another male that pretends to be a woman, and that male manages to sneak in to the other male's group of women, and then it has sex with all of the little women fish so
that
it can
film.
Spread
That's
its genes.
That's what the Emma Watson movie is about.
I was going to say, Florence Pugh did
why
good
would
job
you
with that.
You're referencing a joke we made off pod.
No, I'm just referencing the film Little Women.
Oh, Little Women.
That's
Emma,
what that's
Emma
about,
Timothy
isn't it?
Chalamet also.
It's where, and it's Florence where, Pugh.
Where, I already said Florence
it's
Pugh.
It's where Timothy Chalamet hides amongst a bunch of little women.
Sorry, I can't swear.
Noah!
He fricks them all.
I feel like didn't we do that before?
Yeah, that was weird. I do feel like that conversation we had before in the past, 365 days or so. But Anyway, moving on. Deja vu. So yes, Luke, you are so right. That is what deja vu is. It's a feeling that something you're experiencing has happened before. It comes from the French, meaning basically, I've seen this all before. I've seen this. It's happened before. Mm. It was first used in 1876 by a French philosopher. Who'd have thunk it? A French person coming up with something French? But Emile Boirac, he's French. I can't pronounce his name, and he's probably dead, so I won't even try. He said it in a letter to his book editor, and later in the published book, The Psychology of the Future.
Presumably that's Le Psychologie de la Future.
So that reminds me of something.
Oh, yeah.
And this is something as well with ADHD, I feel, where it is almost physically painful to do something that is boring, right?
Mm.
Even if you want to do it, if you're not feeling it, it's so much effort.
Yeah, I tell you, I had this really weird memory on this, which is like I had to tidy, I think it was my granny's house for some reason. And I remember like doing about 5 minutes of it and feeling really bored and fed up and being like, this is taking ages. And then something switched in me and I accepted that I'm now in tidying my house. It was like I was like really annoyed about doing it and I really didn't want to do it and I was really bored and I was really resisting it. And then I sort of, something happened where I kind of accepted that I was doing it. And then like half an hour flew by once I like was in tidying Luke rather than wishing I was in TV Luke, but being stuck in tidying Luke. Half an hour went by in a sec. It was so weird. That's where I had that kind of like, oh, whoa, mad.
No, actually, I was literally about to say something almost exactly like that because when I'm really struggling to do something that I find, let's say, boring or I'm not really wanting to do, it's a case of trying to do it for long enough that I get focused on it and everything else then falls away. And so I'm not noticing anything else and I'm just focusing on this thing and then I can do it. It's almost like an activation energy. But you know, maybe everyone goes through that, right? But for me, my personal experience is that it's so much effort to get over, even if that period is like, say, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes of working on a thing and hating every second of it, to get into a point where I'm in a flow state, those 15 minutes can feel so long, like
that's
hours.
So interesting. It's almost like what you said about how when you are doing nothing, you have no reference for how long something's taken, right? It's almost like if you were, because there's no change, right? It's almost like if you were focusing, even though you're trying to do things, if you're focusing entirely on the fact that you don't want to do it and that doesn't change, then that's almost the same as doing nothing and nothing changing, because it feels like time takes ages when you're focusing on something that doesn't change. That's kind of what you're saying. And if, although you might be tidying or doing whatever you were doing when you were resistant to it, you weren't focusing on the thing you were doing. You were focusing on the fact that you didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And that fact did not change in the same way that nothing changes when you're doing nothing. And that's the times when time felt really long to you.
You know, it's interesting, right? Because my notes say that the more change you notice over a given interval, the more time, the longer it seems to take, right? But also, you might only give sort of a subjective time or understand a subjective duration once you've noticed it, if that makes sense. Okay, this is weird. That seems to keep happening.
Going on with the space-time continuum.
Yeah, I feel like we keep on going back to conversations we've had before. But anyway, déjà vu. Some people experience déjà vu quite often to the point where it actually causes them distress. It could be due to substance abuse, migraines, anxiety, depersonalization, derealization, which we did an episode on, not this year, but before with Dodi. It was a really good episode. We've had lots of good guests on the show, haven't we?
Yeah.
Is it weird that I actually, because I know a lot of, I know some stuff about PCOS and I know the way fat distribution works. When I see another woman in public, sometimes I can tell if she's got it or not because of the way her body fat is distributed.
That is so interesting.
And then I'm often right when I get to know them better and I'm like, ding, 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 like because of the way they put on weight and where they put on weight.
This was quite a long time ago. So when I was at uni, which would have been the early 2000s, no idea that I had ADHD or quite a lot of unprocessed trauma. And I was at uni, and actually it's very common for people with ADHD that uni is the first time life falls apart.
Oh yeah.
Because you've had systems in place. Mine was my mum when I was younger. And when I moved away from her, like just my room was chaos. I couldn't go to lectures. My attendance was 5%. And I categorise that as just being a bad person. Turns out it was ADHD. But during that time, on a bid to just really, I was very, very unhealthy in many ways, but I was trying to lose weight. And I bought these amphetamines from the internet, imported from Russia. Yeah, it was like 2005, it's a different time. So I was taking these, I think they were called ephedrine stimulants. And what would happen was, I noticed, oh my God, I can go to lectures. Oh my God, I can do my dissertation by staying up for 2 days straight. I had no idea what I was doing, but I was finding these like highly illegal, unregulated stimulants. And when I took them, it actually was medicating in a really, please do not ever do it, horrible way.
Yeah, yeah.
But it actually worked for me. So I think so many of us have been building our little toolkit of how to make it through.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be amphetamines for everyone. But for a lot of people, it might be alcohol.
Yeah.
Like the rates of kind of alcohol abuse and ADHD, I think you mentioned it before, it's like 5 times more or something like that.
It's really high, yeah.
It's really high. And that is really sad for me because I was an alcoholic all throughout my 20s. And I think when we talk about addiction and alcoholic, like you said earlier, people are like, oh, you're on the heroin. It's like, no, actually, it can be a lot more pervasive than that. I thought I was absolutely fine.
Yeah.
I was like having a few drinks every night. I was partying a few nights a week, cocaine twice a week. Like that was kind of normal in London at that time.
Yeah.
And I didn't know. Like, I certainly wouldn't have thought I was an addict. And I remember once someone saying to me, do you think you're drinking a bit too much? And I was like, oh, you are well boring, mate. Like, our friendship's over. You don't often know until afterwards. It's only now looking back to me, I couldn't sleep without being drunk or weed or sleeping pills. Like, I was never sober.
Mm.
And it's like, it's that part of it. That's what ADHD can do to you. It can just make your daily existence so intolerable that you have to find other toolkits.
What can you tell us about having sex with horses?
Well, since I'm not Catherine the Great, I don't have much to add to that. However, I've been to many a stud yard and... honestly, don't get in the way because those guys are rowdy and... it's very dangerous.
90% of everything we know about dementia is based on 10% of the population.
Mm.
And that's because most of the people in the trials are of white European heritage. And there may well be differences, and it's something we desperately need to address. And there will be differences. So it's something we absolutely need to look at. So this is a big breakthrough. And hopefully it changes the narrative. We can do something. But there's a lot of things we don't know. And there were some groups that responded better, some less as well.
Mm.
For example, if you've had a stroke or if you're on blood thinners, potentially you shouldn't go on these treatments. Also, these treatments are only effective when you are diagnosed at the early stages.
Early onset,
so
yeah. Called
MCI, mild right. cognitive impairment, which is a pre-dementia diagnosis. It means you're kind of not performing as you'd expect, but you haven't yet progressed into what we deem Alzheimer's disease or early Alzheimer's disease. So these treatments are incredible. They do seem to slow it down. It's important we let MHRA and NICE, the two regulatory authorities, to look at these, as you rightly say, look at the data that's available and make the right decisions. And we believe they're going to be looking and making decisions towards the end of next year. And it's only after that they'd be available in the NHS. But the data we've seen does look good. We are really kind of encouraged by the data we've seen. But yeah, there's a lot of hurdles and steps to overcome first.
Who we know we are and the way that we report our attraction going and how our genitals and physiological responses respond correlate more in men than they do in women. And what Geralf was finding here is that lesbians follow a more male typical pattern in that sense.
I am so glad that you're so close to the study, because I took that as an excuse to be like, I'm just going to toss it to Shabba. I'll talk nonsense and then Shabba will do all the hard work. And that's
good. No,
that's how
it's useful when I think, because I've been on both sides. I've helped run some of these studies and I've also been in the porn booth looking at these studies. So it makes
is that what they call it? The porn booth.
It's The porn booth Love in it. The sex lab. It is.
The
it
porn
is what
booth
it is.
In the sex lab. That's a book I want to write. That's fantastic. That would get Guardian top sellers.
Hey, maybe we can visit the porn booth one day. I've gotten in with.
with Geralt.
Yeah, the head of the sex lab. I know that.
Ah, you know the head of the sex lab. Does he own the porn booth? Dude, he built
also,
the porn booth.
Like, the sound insulated. There's walkie-talkies. Ambient lighting. There's a box of Kleenex, babe. I mean, that's how legit.
That's everything you need. You only need as well, if you just add a little sink system in there, you can have your hands a little wash afterwards, you know, just to be extra clean. Maybe like
it's,
a...
It's not as like sleazy as we're making it sound, it's all very official.
Toileting is this big thing, and that's one of the reasons that I... It's another reason why I was like very into Montessori education, is because I went to a lot of different schools growing up. I went to... Like, all in, I went to sort of 7 different educational establishments. And one of them I went to was a Quaker school. And Quaker education is very different to normal education as well. Because in Quakerism, which is a religion, if you don't know, we treat everybody as equal, and adults are expected to treat children as equal as well. Which in very much in Montessori, we do that. We treat children as our equals. We talk to them as our equals. We talk to them as we would speak to another adult. We don't use of children's language or speak down to them. And we explain things to them. And when we needed to go to the toilet in Quaker school, we just said, I'm going to the toilet.
Wow. Yeah. Scandalous.
That would have got me a detention.
See you in a moment.
I'm going
go to
the toilet.
The toilet, and then you come back. Like, cool.
Madness.
Whereas I then transferred out to like the local comprehensive school, and I was shocked and astonished that I suddenly had to put my hand up when I needed the toilet and be denied. And I was like, "Are you not denying me basic human right? Like, yeah. this feels wrong. This is not okay. This is very much not appropriate right here and now." Especially because like I have disabilities, and that it's a whole thing for me. It's a whole thing. So it was really not good, and it's something that in Montessori we start using the potty and the toilet very early on, and toileting independence is really like baked into the school day. So the children are very much like, you learn to trust your body, learn to trust your feelings, deal with it yourself. So we're teaching you how you feel. If you feel like you need to go to the toilet, you go to the toilet. This is you, like you know yourself. I do not tell you how you feel right now. This is about you. So that's a really beautiful part of it that I wanted very much for my children, for them to be able to have that sense of self and to not have someone sort of stand over them and tell them something about themselves.
Yeah.
And so that their lived experience was in some way incorrect.
I totally agree with what you're saying about it being basic human rights. That those are just things that we don't afford to children. We've had a whole conversation about this, actually, Luke and I, on our sister show, After Dark, which you can get on our Patreon. We've spoken all about this, about how we just don't treat children as people. But, you know, having met Rupert, he's so independent, if I could just say. Like, That one time I met him, I was honestly enamored. Just watching him wander around, do his own thing. I know lots of babies and children. Don't ask why. I just do. I know lots of babies and children, and not a single one of them has ever been so just content at doing their own thing, happy to be like, no, I'm gonna go this way. You know, it's not a sort of jingle your keys in front of them to make sure they're still excited and not crying. If he's bored, he's off. You know, I'm going over here. I'm gonna see what's going on over this way. I find that fantastic, honestly.
Yeah, he didn't like cry much as a child or anything. He's very much like that now. So nowadays, if we're like in the kitchen, we're cooking and chatting, he'll just be like, I'm going upstairs to play. Okay. Bye then. He's just gone.
Sure. I love that.
Bye, darling. Bye bye. He'll be up there for an hour and a half and we're like, should we check on our child? Or what do we do in this? No, okay, we'll just leave him. Cool. Yeah, yeah, no, he is pretty good at that. He's great. You can sit him on a plane for like hours. Just give him some little figures and he'll talk to them and make them talk to each other and give him a book and he's hours. Yeah, he's very independent. That's something that Montessori education and Montessori parenting very much fosters is that independence, both of the kind of spirit and independent play.
And I think you did a good job in contextualizing Aspie supremacy by saying that usually this is in reaction to potentially years of people feeling like they're a failure, people feeling like they're inferior, because that is the experience of neurodivergent people in general and autistic people as well. So when they finally can have a label and can get a sense of pride and self-acceptance, sometimes they go to the other extreme, which is, well, I am actually superior. But it's interesting because those are people who are still in the process of deconstructing, because it's not the end. It's not the end of the process. If you stop there, you haven't finished.
Absolutely.
Your journey, because then, you know, you're skipping the part which is self-acceptance, because if you need to feel superior to accept yourself, then you haven't done the work.
And I think what I want to add to that as well, I don't think we've said explicitly, but it's kind of been the undertone here, is that this isn't just coming from a sort of holistic point of view of, well, actually, Aspie supremacy, in quotes there, is bad for holistic people. No, you're also stepping on autistic people, because there are plenty, like, you know, it's autism spectrum disorder. There are a wide range of experiences amongst autistic people. There are some nonverbal autistic people. Yeah. There are some autistic people with learning difficulties and learning disabilities, right? And to say this group of autistic people are, in fact, the best people on the planet, we are smarter than everyone else, and we don't need to deal with those silly social rules that you all get bogged down in, like, dude, that's not really like it's fine if you have difficulty sort of, I say, let's say, intuitively understanding and engaging with, you know, social rules or situations or whatever, that's fine. That's a value neutral thing.
Yeah,
it doesn't, also understanding that is a value neutral thing itself.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are entirely neutral. And no one is better than anyone else because they can or can't do it. That's like saying, people that can run a 100-meter hurdle are, in fact, the best people on the planet. Why? Because I put value on the 100-meter hurdle, and I've arbitrarily decided that that's the determining factor for the best people on the planet. That keeps on happening. I'm just going to get back to deja vu and hope that it doesn't happen again.
Have you spiked my water?
Well, no more than normal. However, temporal lobe epilepsy apparently is the most common cause of frequent deja vu. And apparently the science sort of suggests that with epilepsy, the deja vu episodes come from seizures in the temporal lobe of the brain, or sort of dysfunction in memory regions of the brain, like the hippocampus or the parahippocampus, which I was going to make a Paralympics joke, but I won't.
I was going to make a paragliding joke.
That's the duality of man right there. Paralympics or paragliding. The two genders. And speaking of gender, Luke.
You know, whenever I talk about trans people in sports, even though I am a trans athlete and a trans man who competed in men's sports, nobody is talking really about my experience for the most part anymore. I think I talked more about it before the world exploded on trans women in women's sports, but most people, when they think about trans athletes, are now focusing on trans women. And this is a pervasive problem, by the way. Mm. It's not just in sports. When they think about bathrooms, when they're thinking about drag, when they're thinking about all the other parts of trans people in public, queer people in public, it's mostly focused on anything with women's spaces, right? And you'll notice it's protect women, protect children, protect women's sports, right? Mm. And sort of completely ignores the existence of trans men. This is a historical issue, right? We've seen the over-sexualization, hyper-sexualization of trans women and therefore hyper-visibility as well. With trans men, there's sort of a deletion, an erasure. They don't even exist. And both are misogyny, right? Mm. Both is rooted in misogyny and a focus on policing women, on harassing women, and then with trans men, and then with sports specifically, it's about saying, well, anybody assigned female at birth couldn't possibly compete against somebody assigned male at birth, so it just throws out the trans men because we're, quote, not a threat, and then immediately poses trans women as, quote, a threat. So, you know, that's the I think the framework and the context is really mm-hmm. important. My experience personally, where people are, there's sort of two, well, yeah, there's two main arguments against trans men in men's sport. The first is that if people know that trans men can take hormones if they'd like and also compete on the men's team, so they take testosterone as I did, then they often will say something like, oh, you're doping, it's unfair, right? So that happens a couple times where people will argue about that, in which point I will say, actually, I had my hormone levels tested as I was required to 2 to 3 times a season, every single season. You have to do that in order to actually take testosterone and compete in the men's category. And when you think about that, although the NCAA does require all other athletes to be randomly tested, none of my teammates were ever tested, right? Mm. So I was tested 2 to 3 times more than they were ever tested.
It's like stop and serve.
So, yeah. So Hirschfeld, as I've said, disagreed that sexuality was a choice, or that it was it meant you were mentally ill. He sort of didn't think that binary categories were all that great either. He, at least at one point, was a proponent of the idea of a third sex, or Geschlecht, I think,
sick,
that existed naturally. Although I read somewhere that this was saying that sort of gay men were kind of like a third sex, but then he kind of dropped that idea.
Oh, well, right. We spoke about that in the Gay Uncle episode, didn't we? About how there was like a society in which there were like three genders.
Yes.
One was like caregiving gay men.
Were,
like,
caregiving third, gay uncles.
Gay uncles were, yes, like a third gender.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So that was like the first of our, you know, our Pride Month thing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This was, I think, more an idea that like it was, there was a different gender experience. I don't know exactly, but that wasn't the only sort of way that he landed on there being more than sort of two sexes, or sex not being explicitly binary, right? He put forward the idea of the term sexual intermediaries to describe people who were non-conforming. I'm going to read this verbatim. Included under this umbrella were what he considered situational and constitutional homosexuals, a recognition that there is often a spectrum of bisexual practice, as well as what he termed transvestites. So
this is about like girls who kiss their friends when they're drunk. Situational homosexuality is?
This is describing bisexual people.
Right. Yeah. Just in general,
bisexual people. Yeah.
So he didn't think that being bisexual was a sexuality in itself. He just thought it was somewhere in between straight and gay.
That's not too far off of, I mean, bear in mind, this was sort of, I guess, the burgeoning of this.
And yeah.
He was almost, not revolutionary, let's say, but he was definitely
I would
moving
say
out
it was.
Ahead. No, I know. But I mean, in the very concept that it wasn't a strict binary of straight gay. You know, or like homosexual, heterosexual.
Yeah.
So like the idea of being able to be bisexual, I mean, if you look at being gay as being a choice, you would assume that all gay people are bisexual. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I also remember the word lesbian used to just mean a girl that was into girl.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have to mean exclusively into women.
Yeah, words can change over time, and we don't necessarily know what they used to mean. It's really interesting, you know, how those things evolve. But getting back to this, he was looking into a lot, as I said, transvestites, that was the word that he used. Is that's still fine now, right?
Transvestite is like cross-dresser, really. I don't think many people use transvestite. I know that's what my dad said, that like, I was talking about the T-slur, and he was talking about how like that just meant transvestite back when he was younger.
Mm.
So I think it's just people don't really use that word.
Yeah,
I mean, people don't really use the word cross-dresser either.
I know, I don't. Cross-dresser is like a slur. I expect that to be like a people using that derogatively.
Yeah, this is the difficulty, right? I'm well aware that it's an outdated term.
Yeah,
it's not the one that I would use in my day to day sort of life. Even the concept of it is kind of starting to break down.
Well, that's what I mean, like gender nonconformity. Right? It's just femboy, yeah, I guess.
Like, but you've got tomboys and femboys. Weird that they're both built around boys, but that is a much more specific way of describing this, like what's going on, like this sort of, I guess, concept or like,
yeah,
like identity. And it's difficult, right? Because like this wouldn't even necessarily refer to an identity, just a practice,
yeah,
that one does. I mean, the reason I'm asking, is it offensive? I'm like, I know it's outdated, but like, is it one of those ones that has become like explicitly offensive to say?
Well, you wouldn't call somebody else a transvestite.
No, God,
if
no,
you're talking
no
about the history of
this. Yeah, no, yeah, no. It's just, and the reason I bring this up is because I find it interesting, like as you were mentioning just there, that words can change so much, yeah, over time. And I feel like, not to get mad at the kids, but I feel like a lot of younger Gen Z don't recognize how much language has changed in like our lifetimes.
I mean, like with the words like transsexual.
Oh yeah, like when I was a kid, that's what it, that's that well, was the only term.
When you were a kid, that's what it was, and then that became the norm, and then it changed to transgender, and now there are young kids that say that transsexual is like an outdated term, which, to be fair, I used to think that, but there are a lot of people that still call themselves transsexual.
Yeah,
but so I feel like with that kind of language, it's just up to... all you gotta do is be respectful of the people around you. It's the same with like calling people queer. Like, you wouldn't, yeah, call somebody queer unless they were chill with that, but if you were talking about like a group of people that are LGBT, you might use the word queer.
I hate when people refer to me as an individual,
yeah,
as queer.
Yeah, no, me too.
I don't like it.
Queer creator. I'm like, I mean, yeah, technically. Just wish there was a different word.
I'm just an individual, man. Like, I'm just me.
I'm just some, you know, guy.
I'm like, I can't be put into boxes. No, but it's like, it's because I'm not one of the people that has all of my identities listed in my bios or whatever, because,
yeah,
I have more interesting things to say, like little jokes for myself. No, but so whenever people like want to refer to whatever they think I am, there's not a clear or easy place to find that information. So they'll just be like, oh, umbrella term. But
yeah, it is weird that the word queer is what they use.
Right?
I'm,
yeah,
just like,
it's
weird.
Yeah, it's an odd one. But no, I find it interesting that, you know, I mean, we're like, I'm tentatively using the term transvestite here because I'm like, I remember that was the word that you could use 15 years ago and it not necessarily be derogatory. But now, is it derogatory? Because language changes so much. I mean, if you think about all of the slurs, like so many of the slurs are just a shortening of the thing that it is, which I hate because I love shortening words. But if you do it with some words, you're slurring it up, buddy.
The T-Sailor was so close to being a cute nickname.
Yeah, no, yeah. But again, getting back to this. So he was, as I said, he was knowledgeable on sort of all of this stuff. When I say knowledgeable, like, I mean, back in the early 1900s.
He was a woke king, Corey. You can just say it.
He was woke. He was woke for the early 1900s, right?
Yeah.
He's woke
for most people now.
No, 100%.
Oh, yeah. Not woke enough for the wokes, but too woke for,
too, yeah, woke for most people. Yeah.
As I said, he was talking about sexual intermediaries, transvestites, situational and constitutional homosexuals. So it was including people that would want to wear the clothes of the opposite sex, as it says on Britannica, and those who, and God, this is a quote, from the point of view of their character, should be considered as Britannica says, the opposite sex. So basically, whether you're, did we agree on like cross-dresser? Like whether you're like femboy, tomboy, like cross-dresser, if that's the term you want to use.
Gender non-conforming.
Well, yeah, I mean,
but that's like not clothes specific.
No, because, yeah, so it's whether you're like, you're just dressing in clothes for like the fun of it, or like because it's like, it's not necessarily related to like a gender experience or whatever.
Well, that's, yeah, what gender non-conforming isn't about identity, is it?
No, yeah, it's just
more
being,
just about. But stereotypes.
Like, I mean, it's gender non-conforming to wear bloody women's trousers, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's a large range of what gender non-conforming, yeah, can mean. But my point is that when he said transvestites, I think that was referring to both trans people and, I guess, what you would classically sort of,
yeah,
understand as a transvestite.
Yeah, it was kind of just like a catch-all for...
Yeah, and I want to be clear that this may sound offensive now, but it wasn't then.
Yeah. I mean, has anyone seen Rocky Horror?
Oh my god. But like, yeah, so it's just like, it's like one of those difficult things where it's like, yes, he had trans people under the umbrella of transvestite, but also he was you don't want to think of him as being transphobic, you know. I want to make that clear to anyone who's,
yeah,
like maybe very sensitive about wording and stuff listening, because that's what a lot of people are nowadays.
He was our friend.
So he worked with a soldier, and this soldier said, he described wearing women's clothing as the chance to be a human being at least for a moment, which like
right that's I mean I feel that but that's so sad
I know, but like it's one of those things where it's like this experience is for anyone being like oh this is a new thing this is a fad blah 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 this these experiences have clearly existed for I mean, like a century at the very least.
I mean more than that. Not even in like European culture, just like all across the world. There's like always been like two-spirit people or people in like different like I'm not even going to get into that.
No,
but
there's so much.
Yeah, it's everywhere and it always has been.
So I mean, he also this is mad like reading all of this because I was like this what did this dude not know about, right? Yeah. It's like I thought Tumblr in 2014 invented all this stuff. Like he was inclusive of people who had no fixed gender, which I mean Britannica is saying is close to our concept of gender fluidity or non-binary identity.
Yeah.
And it says as well, most important for Hirschfeld, these people were acting in accordance with their nature, not against it.
Like, I like that.
Yeah.
I like that because people call everybody unnatural. It's like, no, this is specific just what they're like.
Yeah, exactly. And that's I think that's a really interesting point that doesn't really come up much anymore. The sort of they're acting in accordance with their nature. They're just acting how they do, how they should sort of thing. And that's like a really important thing that I feel is lost.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting that like back in those days there was nothing that was like convincing them to do those things. It's not like they met up with their friends that cross-dress and that's how they ended up doing it.
They weren't even putting things in the water that made the frogs gay yet. And yet, here they were.
And I just want to take this moment to step up on my little soapbox and talk about transgender people for a moment. Or more specifically, people that don't like transgender people. TERFs, primarily. So I'm looking at the camera now. Hello. Many people who are transphobic, TERFs, they will say, transgenderism is a form of conversion therapy. They take normal gay people who are confused about their gender identity because they're gay and the world is homophobic, and they transition them into straight people, and that's conversion therapy, and that's bad. Shut up. And I am actually, that's my annoyed voice I'm using, okay? You don't get to hear that serious, pissed off voice from me very often, but I'll use it now because I'll tell you what. Conflating letting someone transition, affirmative gender care, with conversion therapy kind of betrays a fundamental misunderstanding of what conversion therapy is. It is torture, okay? Someone who is undergoing conversion therapy is not really undergoing it willingly, right? There are pressures around them that are making them do that. And you could say, oh, there are pressures around trans people that make them be trans. Like, all of their friends are trans and it's cool to be trans. Yeah, okay, sure. Even if that were the case, do you not think that the second you are visibly trans in public, all of the social pressure against being trans would force you to stop being trans? If it was so easy for like five or six friends who realize, oh, actually, I'm not the gender I was assigned at birth, if it was so easy for them to influence you into being a different gender, do you not think that the massive, overwhelming public transphobia would force anyone that was that easily led to stop being trans pretty much immediately? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Affirmative gender care is nothing remotely similar to conversion therapy at all, because it is patient-led. You ask the patient, hey, how do you feel? Do you feel this way? Do you feel that way? Here are the options that you have. This is what you can do. You can also not transition at all. Do you want to know how I know that? Because I've read the actual things that people are given. I've read what Planned Parenthood gives out. I've looked into what happens in the UK. I fucking know what I'm talking about, okay? I don't think you do. I think you just hate trans people and you see conversion therapy and you're like, actually, that's a really useful tool for me to use against trans people. And if that's the case, fuck you. You, okay? Letting people transition, letting people be comfortable and happy in themselves is nothing like conversion therapy. It is nothing like the torture that thousands of LGBTQ plus people have had to endure because of social pressures to make them straight, okay? And if you're someone that even thinks of saying anything remotely similar to that, that trans people are using conversion therapy to turn gay people straight, shut up. You're a horrible person, and I hope you learn better. Okay, I hope you can look back on this time and realize, oh man, I was a bad person. I hope you can look back and feel embarrassed, because ultimately it's nonsense. It's hateful nonsense. And one last thing, gay trans people exist. In fact, a lot of trans people are gay, okay? That's, there you go. Nail in the coffin. Your argument makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Off back to wherever you came from and take Robert Galbraith with you.
Yeah, what Corey said.
So back to the effects of conversion therapy, Luke. Do you want to talk about them?
Universally bad?
Ding, ding, ding. You got it. Yeah. No. There is no report of change in sexual orientation, and reports of success are unpersuasive due to serious methodological limitations and sometimes major flaws in study designs. Almost as though incredibly biased people are trying to make fake studies to make it seem as though the torture that they're performing on LGBT people or, you know, other marginalized groups is actually a-okay, because that's not something that's ever happened in science before. A group of powerful people saying, hey, we don't like this group and we're going to use science as a means to oppress them. God forbid that ever happened in the past, present, or future. We don't have any episodes on that whatsoever. Wink. Anyway, basically it doesn't work at all. From one paper I've got here, lifetime exposure to conversion therapy and psychosocial health amongst midlife and older adult men who have sex with men. There's a study that looked at about 1,000-ish men and asked them about conversion therapy and whatnot, and they found that men exposed to conversion therapy had 2 to 2.5 times the odds of reporting psychosocial conditions. And basically, yeah, the idea is that it being exposed to conversion therapy makes you not good. It makes you sad. There's lots of trauma that can come from it. A study on transgender people found that those exposed to conversion therapy were more likely to be unemployed, have a lower household income, have an increase in self-deletion attempts and lifetime history of suicidal ideation and mental distress. Also, conversion therapies can encourage family rejection, which plays a role in poor mental health and substance abuse outcomes. And if we talk about social prejudice as well, there's lots of evidence that societal prejudice causes significant medical, psychological, and other harms to LGBTQ plus people. I've actually got some data here for you on that. This little study that was done, I think, by San Francisco State University, they found that compared to LGBT young people who were rejected by their families compared to those who weren't rejected by their families, they're more than eight times as likely to have attempted suicide, nearly six times as likely to report high levels of depression, more than three times as likely to use illegal drugs, and more than three times as likely to be at high risk for HIV and STDs. Being sort of disowned or not accepted by your family, not many good outcomes there.
Who could have known?
I don't know, Luke. This is all crazy to me. This is all brand new. It's absolutely mad. Basically what we found is the efforts to change people's sexuality, their sexual orientation, is bad. It doesn't do much to help them. It just causes trauma, mental distress, lots of harm, poor mental health outcomes. Oh, and also doing that for gender identity, which people are very much behind doing, by the way. There are plenty of people out there who are, they say they're therapists, and they're like, yes, we don't like the affirmative model of gender care. So what we do is we do therapy to really root out the problem and convince these people that they're not trans. Some of them are trans. In fact, a lot of them probably are trans. Stop trying to talk them out of being trans because you don't like trans people, freak. As I was saying, Luke, these forms of sort of conversion therapy, let's call them what they are, there's less data on them, but the data that we do have... Can you guess?
Oh, I think it's 100% effective and actually very sexy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? Well, yeah. You'd be dead wrong, Luke.
Oh, no.
I guess you got to join your best mate, Robert Galbraith, that transphobe who may or may not have written a book series.
And I need to get a new job.
No, yeah. Do you want to say what your opinion is seriously?
My opinion seriously is that I think it will be as effective, maybe even less effective than gay conversion therapy. I don't think it will work. I think it just causes a bunch of trauma. Yeah, that's. I think it's exactly the same thing.
Yeah, pretty much there, mate. Pretty much. And so that is more or less it. I had a little section on trans conversion therapy, but like ultimately we've kind of covered it, and we could probably do an entire episode in and of itself. But the fundamental thing here is we need to protect all LGBTQ plus people from conversion therapy, whether they're transgender, whether they're, you know, non-binary, whether they're gay, straight, lesbian, queer, intersex. I don't care. If they're under the LGBT umbrella, you're not touching them with any conversion therapy over my dead f***ing body.
What is happening?
I do not know. Anyway, deja vu. I mean, yeah, look, we think, I guess, that it comes from your brain, basically like wires sort of crossing in your brain, like two bits of your brain that are kind of close together sending signals, and those signals kind of getting mixed up. So your brain is experiencing something new, but part of your brain that's kind of like sort of doing memory stuff is like, hey, I'm active also. And so, you know, your brain is thinking, well, this has happened before, because what else is it going to think with the inputs? It's kind of like, you know, kind of what we've spoken about before, wherein sort of reality is kind of subjective, do you know?
Interestingly enough, autism also affects executive functions, which is less known. And yeah, that's usually...
Are you reading my notes, man? Are you skimming ahead? Sorry. Well, no, go on.
That's also... Well, yeah. So there are many overlaps like this one, for instance, but it tends to manifest or affect people in different ways. But yeah, autism also covers executive function, which is something that my colleague Sheila Henson talks a lot about, because earlier I said that I was one of a coach for the Meerkat squad, but it's important that I mention that I'm one of three. Mm-hmm. So I didn't start it myself. So there's also Sheila and Lena, my colleagues, who there's three of us. I'm not taking credit, all the credit for me. Thought it was important that I mentioned that.
Meerkat's Roman packs, we know that. That's all
yes.
good.
No worries.
But yeah, so let's just quickly cover the prevalence and some stats on ADHD, and then we can get into the real meat of the episode. Yeah, so I mean, if we look at it globally, in kids, it's about 5% of kids are estimated to have ADHD. Mm. Yeah, which at that point, right, 5% of people.
That's more than there are gingers.
True. Like, it's more
Do
than
I
there
have
are.
A hair condition?
There's more than there are like people in many countries, right?
Yeah.
You know, when you look at it that way, it's not terribly uncommon. And if you look at it as just a sort of, this is disorder, this is a way your brain goes wrong. Well, is it that, or is it just another neurotype? Right? I mean, if we really break it down, neurotypicals, and that's meaning people, you know, that don't have a neurodivergent condition or a neurodevelopmental disorder or anything along those lines, are neurotypicals even all the same neurotype? Probably not, right? Probably not. The thing is, we've spoken about this before in the episode that we did about Freud. When it comes to psychology or anything to do with that sort of area, you know, when it comes to people and how they work, putting people into boxes is very useful, but we need to remember that the boxes aren't real. And when we draw very hard lines around these boxes and say, this box is a real thing, and everyone in it, they are defined by this real box, bad thing to do, probably going to get yourself into some trouble.
Earlier, when we were talking about all of those terms that keep changing, and for people listening, it might sound like, well, you know, that's so many labels flying around, and then one minute you're this and then the next minute you're that. But it's also important to remember that those are labels, and labels can be useful. So if it helps you, then by all means use the label. But some people are not comfortable with labels. So, you know, that all of those positions and relationships with labels are valid. To some people, having a label such as autism or ADHD is validating, because it confirms that their experience or things that they've experienced all their lives, it lets them know that other people have thought about it, other people have theorized about it, studied it, and so it's not all in their minds. Because
they're not alone.
They're not alone, and they did make it up. So there is value to labels for those who want them. And it's kind of like gender as well. It's like all of those labels, the exact boundaries are completely arbitrary and made up, but if it serves you, by all means use it. If it does not serve you, do not feel like you have to submit to them, but also do not try to impose a label on others or deny the label that they choose for themselves.
Okay, man. What? This is, are you doing this? Are you pranking me? Am I being punked? Is Ashton Kutcher around here? Huh? Well, come on out, Kutcher! Get out!
I don't know what that's a reference to.
Punked yeah. from the 90s with Ashton Kutcher, or the noughties. Decade where I was a child.
Sure, television.
You're a director, Luke. Have you not
of
seen
films?
Have you not seen the beautiful Punked?
No.
Okay, well, after this episode, we're definitely going to watch some Punked. But back to
We've talked about this in the past. Psychiatry has one of its problems that I think psychiatrists are generally aware of, or psychology as well, psychology actually specifically, is that they place a lot of emphasis on individual responsibility, right? So if you go into a psychiatrist and you go, I'm going to mix those up from time to time. If you go in to speak to a therapist, right, and you say like, oh, the world's unfair, and there's nothing, and I feel like the stuff is stacked against me for a variety of reasons. Maybe it's my gender, maybe it's my race, maybe it's my economic circumstance.
These are all things that Lucas said specifically to his therapist.
the therapist's perspective is generally to try and figure out ways that you can help yourself, right? And not necessarily to just criticize the world and say the world is unfair and unjust and you're right to feel bad about it. That might be a part of it, but ultimately they're looking for solutions. And that can mean that I think sometimes psychology can feel like a kind of right-leaning field. It can feel a little bit conservative because it's ultimately saying, it can feel like it's saying, you're the problem. Individual responsibility, you're the problem. Get on with it and figure out the ways you're perpetuating it rather than blaming the world. And that can be a little bit invalidating.
Let's talk about the cost of prisons. What do you think the sort of average cost per prisoner is for a prison?
I reckon about 30 grand.
Man, you're on fire today. I'm not joking. So The Ministry of Justice has several different methods of estimating the average cost per prisoner. The 2019 to 2020 figures show that in England and Wales, the average direct cost per prisoner was £28,974.
Wow.
But taking into account all resource expenditure, the overall cost per prisoner was £42,670. So per person, they are costing more than the median income for the UK. Now, £32,300 is the average median income for the UK, and we are spending more than that on prisoners.
How about you get all the prisoners who are in prison probably for doing stuff because they were poor,
mm-hmm,
like, and then give them £30,000 a year to just like bop around their life not doing crime.
But that's not fair.
And also stimulate the economy have less people incarcerated.
But that's not fair.
Yeah, I know it's not fair.
I've not committed any. I would just commit a crime so that I can have a nice life. Oh,
yeah.
I've seen the problem here.
Yeah,
I figured it out.
That's the problem. The problem is you don't look after people who don't do crime.
Man,
so you can't look after people who do crime. It's really... Oh, it's so annoying! I am not a fan of what is happening to us.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what happens to some people. Two-thirds of people, in fact, Luke.
Oh, yeah?
Deja vu! And I think we're within that two-thirds right now, and maybe the listeners are too. I don't know what's going on.
We're all in this together.
I don't know what's going on. We're Wildcats. What team? Wildcats. Okay, I'm just going to keep on going with this. But yeah, apparently deja vu decreases with age. The frequency decreases with age. And we're getting older, so hopefully this weird stuff doesn't happen again.
Please, Lord.
On top of the fact that race doesn't work on that individual level, you know, in that... If people having children together means that you're no longer that race, and you're like, it doesn't work with everybody slice. Even if you say that mixed is its own race and everyone then is mixed, like at what point do they become not mixed? And it's no longer socially or culturally relevant at that point, because you could look entirely white but then be technically mixed because of what, a great 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 granddad. It doesn't work.
Yeah,
you could even say that, like, I mean, that's even going on off the idea that different races themselves are genetically distinct, which works kind of with animals. The reason that we see the reason we see a lot of subspecies in other animals and whatnot is because, you know, they go to a location, and the geography of that location can often keep them, there are factors that keep them in a specific area. I was gonna say this earlier, but great, like, you know, we are apes, right? That is what we are. Where can you find apes today? Where can you find chimpanzees, orangutans, and bonobos today? Our three closest relatives.
I feel like the zoo is the wrong answer.
can you find them across all of the continents as widespread? No,
I don't think you can. No.
That's because humans have this like this continuous travel thing. Like we continually migrate from place to place, 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 right?
Yeah.
Which means that you don't see distinct pockets of sort of you know, gene pools, let's say, it is a continuous spectrum, because like you go to a place, you see a hot like, you know, a hot lady from a different place. Oh, hey, hot lady from different place, should we maybe have a kid? Yeah, okay, cool. And like that is one way of it happening, but people just move around a lot, you know. We've been traveling across the world for ages. Also, earlier I think I might have said that gorillas were related to us as closely as chimps and whatnot. They're not. Our closest relatives are bonobos, chimps, and orangutans.
Yeah.
Just to be clear, in case anyone's in the comments. But the point being that, you know, that genetic variation that you think is so distinct, like it stops at the edge of a race, that literally cannot happen because we have not been genetically distinct, you know, like at all, like basically the entirety of us existing. We even bred with Neanderthals. We're like a different subspecies from us, you know. And like kind of adding on to that, like the idea that races exist in and of themselves is just it is utter nonsense, because there are more differences between us, between, you know, people of one race than there are between people of different races.
Yeah.
You know, like within that population. So like nothing in science supports this. Not only is it logically unsound, it's also just like evidentially wrong. Like it is demonstrably not true.
You know, I used to think that deja vu was like a parallel universe me and me like meeting up again.
I love that idea.
We're back together. Great.
Whee! Yeah, it's weird. When I experience deja vu, it's like, oh, I remember this happening, but not in the sense of like, sort of, you know, I remember this happening before. It's like, wait, I remember thinking this exact thing is going to happen. It's like I can see into the future and I just forgot until it happened.
Yeah, for me, the deja vu experience is like, I don't know if this will make sense, but it's like it exists outside of time.
Yes.
It feels like I'm back here again.
It's like Arrival.
As if I'm a sort of like conscious blob, and I'm like, oh, I've been this conscious version of Luke Cutforth before.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like, that's what I mean when it feels like I'm saying, like looking into the future, but I've forgotten until this moment. It's almost as though, like, that's looking at it from a sort of linear point of view where we'd normally look at things. But what I kind of experience is, that where I'm like, I've seen this before, but not like I've experienced this before.
Corey's experienced it before.
Yeah.
I've experienced it before.
Oh, yeah. And it pulls me out of myself a little bit where I'm like, it's quite
derealizing, isn't it?
It is. It's one of those moments where it makes you think like, oh man, are we just consciousnesses that is multi-dimensional and extra dimensionally channeling into peoples?
And then science comes along and goes, no.
Yeah, then a second passes and I'm like, ha ha, funny thing on TV. You know?
I like that Doctor Who episode. Anyway, back to being Corey. It's
like, honestly, those moments where I'm pulled out of myself, I'm like, oh, what? And with almost no warning, I don't even know when it's happened, because if I know when it happens, obviously that would probably pull me out again. But you're just like, ha, me again, bloop, bloop. And you just get back into being a dumb, bearless monkey with no tail, which I guess is in some ways preferable to being an extra-dimensional consciousness, and in some ways not.
You ever listen to a baby's cry pitched down?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
It sounds so good. Just like a dude has been like punched.
What we could do right now is I'm going to go, if I pitch that up in post, I'm probably going to sound a little bit like a baby.
That's true. And we'll now we'll listen to that right this moment. Didn't that sound like a baby?
Whoa.
Wow. I really hope that sounded like a baby. If not, just drop in a baby sound and everyone will be like, wow, that really sounded like a baby.
The point here is not necessarily to go through all of the different sort of individual terms that people have come up with to describe their own personal experience of being aromantic. The point is just to understand that aromantic is not just a single term. It's kind of an umbrella term that encompasses lots of, you know, much more specific identities. But the same can be said of anything, because categories aren't real. And if we want to be specific about who we are, necessarily we're going to just invent more.
You're just going to end up at people.
Yeah, and until you get down to a name. Yeah. And the name just tells you everything about that person.
Yeah.
That's actually a really good way to run society. Why don't we just name people as a list of every single trait that they are specifically? Your name is an entire book about you. And that's how we refer.
Like your name is like a series of letters that you can look up on a centralized. This is starting to sound like left-wing conspiracy theory. liberal elite wants to put everyone in a database. But what I mean is like you can just, yeah, you eventually can just look up. I'm XZ56241. And then you can look up all of my identities inside
there. That's
not
what I mean. That's because that's still using categories. Because okay. It needs to be individual because everyone's an individual. So what I'm saying is you have an entire book that you write by yourself that describes every feeling that you have. And right. That way we all know each other on the deepest possible level.
But that rules out people who don't really understand themselves at all.
Do you know what? If we're going to have world peace and the only people we oppress are the people who don't understand themselves, that would still be bad, okay? Oppression is bad. I know you thought I was going to say it was going to be fine. No. No. So emotional dysregulation, it's not unique to ADHD. You can have emotional dysregulation with many other disorders. In fact, yeah, it's kind of like a diarrhea situation, right? Mm. Lots of things can cause diarrhea.
Hey, yeah.
Lots of things can cause emotional dysregulation, or emotional dysregulation can be related to a lot of different things, you know, mood disorders and whatnot. But yeah, no, ADHD is linked to ADHD. So I've got a quote from a 2014 paper here, which I'm not going to read out, actually. I've just changed my mind. But I will tell you the gist of it. Would you like to hear the gist?
Please.
So the gist of it is essentially, in 2014, this paper was saying, hey, emotional dysregulation, it seems to be, you know, pretty tied to ADHD. In fact, you know, it could be a core part of ADHD. Maybe. Who knows?
One of, like, the Ten Commandments.
Yes, the Ten Commandments of ADHD. Mm-hmm. Thou shalt not pay attention.
Be really sexy. Two, endearing.
Go on, please, more.
Three,
yep.
Run really fast. Four, be really agile. Five, have really nice hair. Uh-huh. Six.
I feel like these are kind of redundant.
I feel this is just you describing how you view yourself.
It's really not.
You describe yourself as slippery all the time.
No, he does describe himself as agile. No one's caught me yet.
I have caught you several times.
It makes it feel good, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, you can't catch the slippery snake.
Finish your 10.
Six, really bouncy, like really just general spring. Just really, just like a just general spring, like Tigger. Uh-huh. Seven, need sound-canceling headphones, things too loud.
Okay.
Mm. Eight, not be able to get out of bed when really want to. Nine, take four-hour baths. 10... annoy everyone around you.
Okay, you forgot emotional dysregulation.
That's like quite that literally.
That's number one, right?
No.
We found the hidden commandment.
Well, the 11th one. Congratulations, Corey.
Okay, man. Here's the thing. I think I've exhausted everything I can say on deja vu. We don't really know exactly why it happens, I guess. Epilepsy can cause it. It's kind of crossed wires in the brain. But yeah, it's something that is just a kind of universal, almost human experience. And that's all I can say on deja vu. I hope none of that stuff happens again, Luke.
I think it's going to happen all over again. We're going to make this episode again, and then all of that's going to happen again forever.
I don't know how they sort of view this, because I don't know how common this is anymore. I mean, at least when I was a kid, it wasn't a terribly uncommon thing to just give your kid a hit every now and then. Like, you know, like obviously not. And this is what's going to sound really, really weird, I think, to people that don't have this experience, is that when I say it's obviously not, you know, hitting them really bad, it's just hitting them so that you hurt them so that they don't do the thing again.
Yeah.
To be clear, I think all of it is bad. I'm not defending any of this. It's just you've got to try and approach it from that cultural view to put it in context. And I'm curious as to whether kids, you know, 10 years younger than us have that same sort of cultural understanding, because I know for a fact that they don't have that understanding of certain slurs and whatnot that were commonplace, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So, you know, hitting a kid has become less and less acceptable. But is it at the point where kids nowadays would think it's just absolutely abhorrent the way that we do, but, you know, they don't have the sort of cultural context to understand what it was like back then?
Yeah, I don't know, because when we're talking about slurs and stuff, right? So like that would come under the law, right? So if you're using slurs, that would be, you're generally using slurs against what would be legally defined in the UK as like a protected group, right? Mm-hmm. So you'd be talking about people who are gay, you'd be talking about people with disabilities, those kind of slurs that were pretty commonplace when we were kids.
Those two, yeah.
Yeah, well,
serious. Like, those are the two main ones that were used.
Yes, I didn't hear a lot of like race-based slurs used by the kids in my school.
I did.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. But as like a derogatory term to somebody whom it didn't apply to.
Yeah.
Well, you did experience a few very specific ones.
They were trying their hardest. They gave me the wrong racial slurs, but they were trying.
But using slurs to mean somebody who has a disability.
Using the R slur or calling someone gay in the sense that gay means bad.
Yeah. Would now be legally protected, right? So like that would be like, to a certain extent, the police aren't probably going to do anything, but there will be some sort of hate speech law for protected groups, right? In the UK.
The Equality Act was only in 2010?
Okay, well, that's bad.
Sorry, I was just like, oh, yeah, I guess it is legally protected, but has that not been around for... Nope, 2010, no, sorry.
Not long. But whereas the law hasn't caught up with, for example, the idea that spanking kids is not good. So what's so interesting is if you're using the kind of slurs part as a comparison, the law has changed on that since we were kids, but the law on the spanking part, maybe it's become slightly stricter, I don't know, but it's definitely not caught up. So whether that then means that there's a difference in opinion among sort of Gen Z or like kids, I don't know if it'd be quite so like hard line as it is with things like slurs, which are, you know, the world's caught up in our country at least and said that's not acceptable.
Yeah, and I guess another interesting wrinkle to this is that Gen Z kids still could have been hit by their parents.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
I mean? And so they could still be carrying that with them. So whereas parents now, I mean, if I see a parent now hitting their kid, I'm intervening. I'm stopping. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care. If I see a parent hitting a kid on the street, I'm stopping that because that's not right. I don't care if you're a parent. You don't own a person. Okay, you don't get to do what you want to a person just because you managed to pop them out your body, all right? Like, that doesn't give you full rights over them as though they're an object. So, yeah, it's really insane to me that we had a law against, you know, hitting children, you know, assaulting children, but there's a caveat if it's reasonable punishment.
Or if you're the parent, yeah.
The caveat is if you're a parent and it's reasonable punishment.
Yeah, yeah. But even just the fact that you're a parent means that there's a different law applies when it comes to corporal punishment. I feel like if you ask most people, do you kind of agree with corporal punishment? They'd probably be like, well, actually, to be fair.
No, Luke.
The country we're in, maybe quite a lot of them would.
No.
Okay.
I turned out all right.
Okay. I live in a bubble.
You know, much like the Titanic, whilst poor people were drowning elsewhere in the world, we had a full international sort of search for these people that we knew, well, I mean, not we, but that some knew were basically already dead. And it's history kind of rhymes, doesn't it? And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have gone after them. Absolutely. Anyone that's in danger in the sea, we should maintain efforts to do that. But whilst, you know, migrants or refugees are drowning, and being ignored, it seems a bit odd for, you know, four billionaires and one of their kids, or three billionaires, a millionaire and a kid to be top priority when so many other people are drowning and currently dying. And that was happening before, you know, the submersible even went down. But yeah, that is it. Luke, you got anything to add?
Well, I think the last thing I wanted to add is that, like, This is obviously an incredibly dangerous activity taken out by some incredibly rich people. And one of the things that sort of frustrates me and makes me sad about this is, like you were saying, Corey, there was this boat at the same time with 750 migrants on it, all drowning. And we didn't read, no one wanted to do anything about it because they're not going to take ownership over those people. And when we do something incredibly dangerous like this, essentially from an insurance perspective, your activity, your like the thing you've decided to do is being underwritten by the governments of the world, right? Mm. Which is us. So like in the same way that like there's this funny statistic that's like people that jump out of aeroplanes in order to raise money for the NHS, actually take more money from the NHS by the amount of times they get injured and how many times it costs, much money it costs the NHS to fix them, than they actually raise the NHS. I think, please check that statistic, but I'm fairly certain that's true. And in the same way that, like, you know, you might get on a submersible and you might pay £200,000 to some random company and you might sign a waiver saying that you're not going to sue the company if anything happens to you. But ultimately, when something does happen to you, that company's not going to be able to get navy ships from around the world. They're not going to be able to get like deep sea exploration craft. The amount of millions of pounds that will have been spent trying to recover these people for doing something demonstrably stupid by the other attempts that were made with similar craft, whilst 750 migrants are drowning in the sea, just makes me really quite sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just makes me incredibly sad when, like, you know, these people have got way more money than they could ever spend in a lifetime, and they're doing something that everyone else has to sort of pick up the pieces for when it goes wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing, you know, these companies are putting people at risk and relying, on the governments to bail them out.
Because they could never get an insurance policy to cover that.
No.
They could never get, like, Oceancraft or whatever it's called, Oceangate, could never go to an insurer and go, right, we want you to underwrite the possibility that our craft gets stuck 4,000 meters under the sea and you have to go and get the military to come and rescue us.
Yeah.
No insurer would ever give you a policy for that. So it falls on essentially the public, everyone else is the military. And I'm not saying that shouldn't happen, but
it absolutely should, though. Yeah, you know, you're right. It should happen.
But when it's done willingly, knowingly, and deliberately putting people at risk with loads of people telling you it's probably the wrong thing to do, I think there needs to be a little bit more thought about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when you're going somewhere where the pressure is 400 times higher than, like, sea level in a vehicle that, like, you know, really can't do that more than once, with people that you've got to pay you, and a child, like he's 19, but like a child, you know, it's just obscene. It's a flagrant display of, you know, I mean, I think this situation, as we discussed in the After Dark episode we've done on this, this situation really demonstrates wealth and the problems with hoarding wealth nowadays. You know, we have 5 people now dead from an obviously stupid venture that would never have happened had people not been trying to hoard and gain more wealth, and then having more money than they know what to do with, and spending one guy $500,000 for him and his son to go down and look at the Titanic on a screen in one of the most dangerous places they could be on the planet. You know, it truly is just, and all the while, you know, we have migrants drowning. And how much could the, God, 4 passengers or maybe 3, 4 passengers, how much could the $750,000 to $1 million have helped, you know, the people that were drowning there? I mean, probably a fair bit.
Well, how much could the $750,000 plus all the money spent trying to rescue them help the 750 migrants on the boat?
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. It's...
As well. Did you see Mr. Beast got invited on it?
That would have been horrible.
He tweeted like a screenshot of like him having been invited on this thing.
Deary me, Jesus.
And he said no.
Good.
Imagine what an internet news story that would have been if Mr. Beast was stuck at the bottom of the Titanic.
Okay, look, we need to do something really quickly just to get this episode out. It's the quickfire quiz.
Dun 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 da, dun 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 da, dun 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 da, dun 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 da, dun 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 da. Edition.
Luke, do you remember the rules for the quickfire quiz?
Of course I do. I've been here many times before.
The rules for the quickfire quiz are the same as they always are. I will ask one question. That's one question between you and the audience. If you get the answer right before Luke gets it right, then you win. But you have to answer the question after I finish asking it. Is that all good with you, Luke?
That's fine with me.
Gosh darn it, it happened again. Okay, this quickfire quiz question has never been done before. What language is Deja Vu in?
French.
Ding, ding, ding. That is correct. Thank gosh we are done.
Are we free?
We're free, Luke. I think we might be. But before we go, we've got to thank all of our patrons, with an extra special thank you to Exact producers Danito and Glitch Rabbit. And thank you for watching. You can find the full references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday. And why not leave us a nice wee comment? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com. SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at Not Corey everywhere.
You can follow me at Luke Cutforth everywhere.
Bye.
Corey, I don't feel so good.
Luke! Luke!